These several questions are, some of them are excellent questions, and I might compliment you on the questions. There have been some good questions that we've had this week, like this one. And using the term people helper, most of us are probably thinking in terms of helping adults and teenagers. But could you please comment on how we can be people helpers to children? And can you recommend any suitable literature? That's a good question, because sometimes we forget that children need to be helped too. And sometimes we have depression in children, and sometimes we have real psychotic problems in children. And sometimes children are insecure, especially when they get into school and they're put down by their peers. And it's difficult. It's difficult, I'm convinced, to be a kid in the world in which we live. And I think back to when I grew up and think of the struggles that I had. I'm glad I grew up when I did. It's not easy for young people today to deal with the pressures they encounter. And I think the person who wrote this question shows a real sensitivity, which I appreciate. There is not much that has been written on this in one of our blue books out there. We have a book on counseling children. But I must be honest with you, since I'm a long way from home, it is not one of the better books in our series. We have another book that a man is producing on this, and there are not very many books dealing with children specifically. One of the things you should remember in working with children is that they cannot verbalize their problems like we adults can. They know they're hurting sometimes, but they don't know how to say that. So many people who work with children will try to have children draw pictures of what they're feeling or what they're thinking. Or maybe they'll have the children tell stories of what they're thinking. Or perhaps have children play with dolls or play with toys. And as you watch these children play with toys, they will often express what's going through their minds. Ask them, for example, to play house with you. You may feel silly talking their language, getting down on the floor, but you need to do that with kids. And have them, sometimes they'll have the mother doll and the father doll. One of our daughters was working in a center for abused children about 6 months ago, and she came to me and she said, "Dad, I couldn't believe it." She said, this young boy, a little kid, he'd come from an abusive home, and he said, "Let's play house." And he said to my daughter, who's in her early 20s, "You be the mother and I'll be the father, and these dolls here will be our children." And they were talking about this, and a few minutes later he said, "I've got to spank these children because they've been very, very bad. I've got to take down their pants, and I've really got to spank them. I've got to hit them very, very hard because they've been so bad." And Jan was saying, "Well, what do they do?" "Well, I don't know, but they've just been bad." And my daughter was so disturbed about this, because she said, it shows the kind of family that this child was in. And just by the playing, sometimes you get a perspective on where the kids are coming from. So remember that children don't communicate like adults do, and so you need to develop some unique and creative ways to work with kids. There are some people who work with children here in our midst. I found that out today. And they can maybe help you as you move ahead and think of some creative ways to work with kids. How can we help folk who continually confront people because they believe that by doing this they are being faithful? Those are hard people to help. Those are the kinds of people I like to ignore. Sometimes I think maybe those people need to be helped from the pulpit, in all seriousness. Sometimes we can be faithful in helping other people, but when you go out and start confronting people and telling them to change, of course you're going to get resistance. And I suspect some of the questions that we've had are questions that are thinking of specific people. And I, of course, have no idea who the specific person this might be, but the person says on the question, both pastors and lay people may feel this way. If you are a pastor, if you are a lay person, be cautious about confronting other people with what's wrong, because you're likely to get resistance. I am a great believer in the power of prayer to change lives. And sometimes the Lord opens marvelous opportunities to talk to people about the struggles they have. And you can sometimes find that God opens opportunities without your having to go ahead and confront things. Sometimes I think we spend too much time thinking about how I am going to solve somebody else's problem. And maybe we have to stand back and say, "Lord, I don't know what to do, and I don't know how to confront this, but I'm asking for you to open up the opportunity and give me the chance to say what I need to say." And the Lord may give you that opportunity to deal with the person in your church or your community who is always doing the confrontation, because that person may not realize the chaos that he or she is creating. Many times when people have gone through burnout and depression and mental illness or have been in prison, often your own perspective of people's responses is impaired. I think this looks like it's coming from a counselor and saying, what do I do if somebody has had these difficulties? My perspective on that person is likely to be impaired. Are there practical ways to determine what is your own perspective that you are projecting, and what is the real response that the person is giving to you? In other words, if you're counseling with somebody, it is very easy for you to bring your own perspectives, your own prejudices, maybe your own biases to the situation. This is a question that has great relevance to our topic tonight. Because many times when people are hooked by pornography, when people are victims of AIDS, when people are involved in homosexuality, when people are involved in abortion, or maybe working in abortion clinics, or inclined to be sympathetic towards euthanasia, when people are involved in some of these social issues that we talk about, sometimes our own attitudes get so much in the way that we don't listen to these people, and we're unable sometimes to hear their struggles and their pain. Well, for one thing, if you have these biases and you have these attitudes, and we've all got some of them, many times our spouses can help us see those biases. Many times other colleagues can help us see some of those biases. And I'm using biases not in a negative sense here tonight. Many times other colleagues can help us to be sensitive to those people. If you feel that you have a strong feelings against people who have been in prison, or against people who have been divorced, or against people who have been involved in mental illness, maybe here's a place where you need to ask the Lord to help you change some of your attitudes, and maybe not spend a lot of time working with those people, because you know at this point that your attitudes might get in the way. But sometimes if you have those attitudes, you also recognize that when you get to know people, some of your attitudes and your biases fade away. We know this with discrimination. I was reading not long ago about a program in which they take Irish children, Protestant children, and Catholic children, and take them to a neutral country for the summer, and they're all together. And these kids discover that they get along well with each other, they like each other, they're friends with each other. And they discover that back home, they're fighting with each other. But when you get together, sometimes you discover we are not as different as you might think. And sometimes that kind of exposure can help. I remember one time when I was with a group of people, and I was talking to a class of students about homosexuality. And I was discussing this in the context of an entire course in counseling, and that was the particular topic that came up that day. Some of the students in the class, they were theological students, and they had some biases against anybody who would struggle with this. And after class, one of the students came up to me and cornered me, and he said, "Gary, I want to tell you something." He said, "I have struggled with this my whole life. Before I was a Christian, I was very much involved in gay bars. I had a lover. I was involved in this." And he said, "To tell you the truth, although I'm a Christian now, and I no longer engage in this behavior, I still struggle with it." And I don't know what came over me, but I said, "How would you feel about sharing this with the class?" He said, "Well, let me think about this." And the next day he came back and he said, "Yeah, I'm willing to share this with the class." What a marvelous attitude that man had. I complimented him, and have several times since complimented him on his honesty and his courage to get up and share with the class. But I can't believe what happened to the class. Here was a class of young men and women who had all of their systems all worked out, what they thought about divorce, what they thought about discrimination, what they thought about homosexuality, what they thought about all kinds of things. And then one of their classmates gets up and says, "I'm struggling with this." All of a sudden, the prejudices melted. And they began to see, here is a brother who is struggling. Now I know what he must be going through. And the whole attitude changed for the rest of that class. I've never seen a class change so dramatically. I wonder how your church might change if somebody who had AIDS talked to them. I wonder how a former mental patient could change a congregation if that person was able, and that's difficult, but had the courage sometime to say, "Let me tell you what I'm going through." I wonder what a former prisoner might say if he or she said, "I was in prison and you didn't visit me. And you didn't visit my family either." And I think those kinds of things can often break down some of the attitudes, because many times prejudice has come about because we don't understand and we feel threatened. And when we begin to recognize the pain that other people go through, then I think we begin to recognize that the people who struggle with problems are not as unusual as we might expect. Somebody else has asked a question about how do you recognize if somebody is ready for counseling? Well, that's hard to recognize. Usually if the person feels that things are not going well in life and they could use a little help, then that person is ready for counseling. This question came in a day or two ago, and I was walking through the display area, and I picked up something from the Catholic Family Welfare. It's a little brochure, and the top says, counseling, who needs it? And there's an answer, everybody at some time. Not a bad brochure. Whoever, if the person who's here who represents that organization, I compliment you on this. You're not overdoing it, but you're saying sometimes, all of us at times, get to the point where we could need use some help from somebody else. It might be from a colleague, it might be from a relative, it might be from a fellow people helper, it might be from a pastor. We can find help from other people. And I suspect we recognize that at times we all need it. And if we find that the stigma against counseling begins to disappear, as it is disappearing in this group, and as I think it will disappear in the churches that you represent, then I think people are more willing to go for that kind of help. Another question said, why are a significant number of psychologists, people like Rogers and Kelly, etc., why are they pastor's sons? Well, it was an interesting question to me because I didn't know that a number of them were pastor's sons. But I did discover something that I was in my reading in preparation for this conference and for this trip to Australia. I recognized that in the who's who of Australia, 1% of the people who are listed in who's who are pastors' sons or daughters. Did you know that? But 1% of the population are not pastors. And maybe there's something that pastors convey to their kids. Maybe there's something that pastors instill in their children. We hear a lot about PKs and the problems they have and the difficulties being a pastor's kid. But maybe some of those PKs grow up in homes where there's caring and where there is sensitivity and where there is a compassion for other people. And those people, those kids, oh, there may be some rocky times, but they grow up and they begin to recognize that my mom and dad weren't so far out after all. And they instill something in their children that sticks with the kids. And they become the people who, if they don't become psychologists or psychiatrists, they become people who are listed in Who's Who Australia and in other publications. I think that's encouraging. I like that question because I think it's a good opportunity to affirm those of you who sometimes feel like as pastors' kids, your kids are never going to turn out very well. Now, those of you who are sitting in the front row will notice that I had another question that fell on the floor. You probably relax, or as you watch that, you wonder what I was going to do. Was I going to ignore it? Was I going to bend down and pick it up? Was it a question that I had already answered? What am I going to do about it? You don't want to embarrass people by getting down and crawling around the floor, especially on the last night when you want to leave a good impression. I already know what it is. But there are some people. The reason I dropped it on the floor was to give a brother an opportunity to be a people helper. I thought he would never come forth. I wanted to see if anybody had learned anything in the last 2 days. You are a good man. The question, I knew what the question was, so I was going to kind of pretend, but here's the question. I can read it now. This is the last one. Can you believe it? The last one. Hallelujah. Why didn't you say hallelujah after something I said in my speech? Anyhow. Well, we realize that tongues is a gift of the Spirit, but how does secular psychology... Boy, that's an interesting way to spell psychology. P-H-S-Y-C-O-L-O-G-Y. Well, I think that they mean psychology. How does secular psychology explain this phenomenon? And what is your opinion on this subject, given that tongues exist in other religions and other cultures? That's a hot question to end a conference with. I could lose about half of you right here. In fact, I might lose everybody right here. Well, let me give you an answer. At least this is... I appreciate this question. It's a good question. Speaking in tongues, glossolalia, you know this was referred to first in the Scriptures on the day of Pentecost. When they spoke in tongues, and each person who was there heard the gospel presented in his or her own language. Later in the Scriptures, when Paul talks about this in 1 Corinthians 14, he's talking about what seems to be a way of praising God in a language which is different from the language with which people normally speak. Now, we know that Christians differ in their discussion of this topic. I can tell you, honestly, where I come from. I'm not involved in the charismatic tradition, although the last time I was in Australia, somebody said, Gary, you really are charismatic, you just don't hold your hands in the air, which I thought was a very interesting comment. But nevertheless, okay, so I don't speak in tongues, but I recognize that when people speak in tongues, that can very well be of the Holy Spirit. And I acknowledge that, and I have no trouble acknowledging that. I also understand, however, on the knowledge of psychology, that when people speak in tongues, it isn't always of the Holy Spirit. And I think many of my charismatic friends would agree with me on this. Because there is evidence from psychology that people can speak in tongues who have no interest in religion at all. Some interesting studies done in Canada on this. They've taken a microphone. They said to people, speak in another language. And they do what sounds an awful lot like the glossolalia in many kinds of worship experiences. And so the many psychologists will come along and say speaking in tongues is something which can be learned and can be duplicated. So we might say, yes, sometimes it's from the Holy Spirit. Sometimes, and these are not necessarily exclusive, sometimes it's the result of learning. Might it also be the result of satanic influence? I think it might be. If you look into the scripture, several times you see, I think in 1 Thessalonians, again over in Revelation, it says that the devil is able to do all kinds of signs and wonders. And he is able to duplicate, in some way, many of the things that are legitimate spiritual effects, spiritual gifts, and spiritual things that are taking place in the church. And if people speak in tongues in Hindu temples, as they do, and if people speak in tongues in worship services that are not Christian, as they sometimes do, then I think we need to recognize that this may also be of the devil. So we have to ask ourselves, how do you know whether it's of the Holy Spirit? How do you know whether it is learned behavior? How do you know whether it is of the devil? Or maybe there might be some overlap between these things. And I don't think you can always tell except for this. I recognize in the scripture that you know whether something is legitimate by the fruits that you see in a person's life. By their fruits you will know them. And if you don't know where somebody is coming from, then maybe you have to watch that person, observe that person. Is there evidence of the Holy Spirit working in that person's life? Do you see the slowly developing evidence of love, joy, peace, long-suffering, meekness, gentleness, self-control, those kinds of things? And that can be a good indication, certainly one, maybe not the only one, but a significant indication of whether or not this is the Holy Spirit's work or whether it's something else.
And this is where we leave Gary with the questions, and we now go straight into the session, which is dealing with the ethical issues. The first that you'll hear him dealing with as we break in is the homosexual question.
There are other people who resist it, who fight it, who, if they have anybody in their church who might be struggling with homosexuality, in essence, tell them to stop, to change it, to do something different, and don't show very much compassion or understanding, like the students in my class several years ago. So you see, the problem is expressed in different ways, and that complicates the issue. But the issue is complex, not only in its causes, and not only in its influence, but also in its expression. See, there are some people who are overtly homosexual, and they acknowledge they're homosexual, they spend time with people of the same sex, they move towards homosexual marriages, which are now legal in California, for example, at least in the San Francisco, which has a large homosexual population. And these people are quite open about it. They engage in sexual behavior with other members of the same sex. Now, the scriptures say some things about that, that I think disapprove of that, and talk against that. But there's a different aspect of homosexuality. What about the people who know that they are primarily attracted to the same sex, but they don't give in to those attractions? They don't engage in any kind of overt homosexual behavior. And they are people who sit in your church like heterosexual people. Some are heterosexual who engage in self-control, and some are homosexual who engage in self-control. See, people struggle maybe whether they're heterosexual primarily or homosexual primarily. They are trying to live a life that pleases the Lord. And some wake up to the fact that I am attracted to people of the same sex. But I'm not going to mention it. I will seek to have self-control, just like my heterosexual colleagues seek to have self-control. Now, to me, it seems to me there's not a lot of difference between these two people. They both have sexual urges. They're both seeking to control those urges. See, one of the books is written by a Christian writer, a pastor. He said, well, people, if a person is homosexual, they should decide to change. The implication is that you get to some point about 15, when you're 15 years old, and think, well, let me see, am I going to be homosexual, heterosexual, or bisexual? Maybe I'll decide that this afternoon. That's not what happens. People get into puberty and they begin to recognize that they are either attracted primarily to the opposite sex or they are attracted primarily to the same sex. And some people who are attracted especially to the same sex are very disturbed about that many times, and they would like to change, but they're not quite sure how they got there, and they struggle with this. And I suspect that there are people in your church that struggle with this. I don't know. There may be people at this conference who struggle with this, and nobody shows them very much compassion, and they struggle alone. See, there's different expressions of homosexuality, which again deals with the complexity of the issue. Then there's different ways of treating it. And this complicates the issue even further. The American Psychiatric Association decided several years ago by vote of the membership that homosexuality was no longer a problem. They took it out of their diagnostic and statistical manual and said, if you're homosexual and you're happy with it, that's no psychiatric problem. We can't counsel people for that. It is unethical, according to the ethical standards of some counseling organizations at home, it is unethical to counsel a person to change his or her sexual orientation. And some Christians have run into some real problems with that. Because you're not supposed to be changing unless the person really is very strongly wanting to change. Well, then maybe that's all right, but you run into ethical issues because of what the profession is saying about this. But then there are people who are involved in deliverance ministries, sincere people. And they say, we're going to deliver people from homosexuality. And they often have former homosexuals who are involved in this ministry. When we had the Congress on the Family several years ago, we had a man there who spoke beautifully, very effective speaker. He said, I was involved in a homosexual lifestyle. I have been delivered from it. And I now have a deliverance ministry. And I'm working with other homosexuals, delivering them from this. He got a lot of media attention. He was a good speaker at the conference. He did a fine job. And about a year later, we discovered that he had gone back to the homosexual way of life. He hadn't been delivered very well. And so there's a great struggle there. And I think some people maybe, yes, I'm willing to admit some are delivered. But I suspect many are not. And that becomes a problem. Or sometimes we deal with homosexuals by rejecting them. We've already alluded to this. I mentioned earlier in the conference that I had edited a book before I came on Christian approaches to counseling. I asked the people to give the topics that they wanted to deal with. And one man sent me a case history of family counseling with a fundamentalist family whose son has AIDS. A fascinating case. Because the family was very much involved in the church and they had rejected their son. Now they are torn between the fact that their son is dying and they don't approve of his lifestyle. But they want to at least show that they care about him. He, in turn, has rejected the family and has rejected the church. So they decide, with the counselor's help, to go back and approach their son. But the son says, I don't want to come to your house because you rejected me. So finally they convince the son that he should come to their house before he dies and have dinner, but he wants to bring his male friend. And they say, no, we won't let you do that. And it's a very interesting account of how the family gets to know each other, how they get to love each other and respect each other, including the male lover who is grieving too, and how they go through this whole period of looking at what the Bible says about this, of showing compassion and forgiveness in ways that are consistent with biblical teaching. But it's an interesting example of the struggles and the complexity of this. And as you know, sometimes people say that this comes about because of relationships with a parent, a father, or a mother. It comes about because of experiences as a child. How do we deal with all these things? Now, I suggest that it is a complex issue. I don't want to keep recommending books. But the book that we did in our series that was done by Earl Wilson, I think is one of the finest books on counseling homosexuals that I've read, and I told him so. Earl Wilson did two books in our series. The first one was okay, and I helped him. We worked a little bit together, and I think we interacted together, like in the center of our diagram this morning, And he came through with this book on counseling homosexuals. He's had a lot of experience in this, and it was a wonderful what he said. For one thing, he said, a lot of my colleagues, when they discover they've got a homosexual, they say, you better change your behavior immediately or I won't stick with you. And he said, therefore, they leave and they go down the street to somebody who doesn't help them. But he said, I stick with them even while they're going through the pain. Remember, if you stick with a person, you don't lose patience. We will reap if we do not grow weary. Now, I use homosexuality because it is one item on the list that is complex. And I suggest that social issues are complex. Secondly, I suggest the social issues are controversial. Let me deal with another item on the list to illustrate this. Euthanasia. This is the idea of people getting older or people getting sick, and we will somehow pull the plug on the machine and let them die. Or we will withhold food from them because they are no longer useful in our society. One of the magazines, the news magazines at home, came out with a cover story within the last 6 months. And the cover story was on the right to live, the right to die. It talked about how that we who are apart from this, we who are not medical people, can talk about it and debate about it in some nice, concise ways. But the doctors who work in the hospitals, the nurses, they struggle with this. And these are difficult ethical issues. This is one of the things that I wanted to put in my notes, and I may have forgotten, and perhaps I should add it here while I'm thinking about it. Most of these issues that we deal with, a lot of how we respond to them depends on how much contact we've had with them. If you've never talked to anybody who's got AIDS, you can have a whole different perspective than if you've talked to somebody who's dying from AIDS. My students who never talked to a homosexual had a whole different perspective when they saw one. If you may have some nice, concise opinions about divorce and when divorce is appropriate until your sister tells you she's going to get a divorce or until one of your kids decides that the marriage is breaking up. And I'm not suggesting you change your theology at that point, but I'm suggesting that sometimes it's much harder to deal with and you get a whole different perspective when you encounter this on a one-to-one basis. Now, here then, we come to the controversial issue of euthanasia. Some of you may remember that several years ago, Francis Schaeffer made a statement in which he said that once we deal with the topic of abortion, and abortion becomes widely accepted in the culture, then the next thing that will happen is that we will become people who are characterized by a widespread acceptance of euthanasia. And I think Francis Schaeffer was right. Abortion has become a major issue around the world. It's not on the list, but it could have been. About a year ago, the Parliament in Canada passed a law on abortion. Prime Minister Brian Mulroney said, "This is probably the most significant piece of legislation that has come before the Parliament in the history of Confederation." This from the Prime Minister, who is living in a country that is in danger of breaking up over the difficulties in Quebec. Because here was an issue that is so volatile. It is an issue in the United States that is, to say the least, a hot issue. And it is an issue which is often characterized by inconsistencies. This shows the controversy. You can go to a hospital where I live, and a person can have an abortion of a child who is a certain period throughout development, and that child can be aborted, and the fetus thrown away. If a child the same age is born prematurely, the hospital will spend thousands of dollars to keep that child alive. Same child, same age. And there's this kind of inconsistency. But this is a tremendously volatile area. And of course it spills over then into the issue of euthanasia. When I was in Holland several years ago, I had an audience of Christians and I said, "Tell me, is it true that here in the Netherlands you can legally cut off the food supply to somebody who is dying so you can let them die?" And they said, "Yes, it is legal here." Some of you are familiar with the Hemlock Society, which is working in legal circles to make death something that is legitimate. Back home, some man not long ago, a physician, designed a suicide machine. Did you read about that? And somebody came into his office and he said, "I'll link you up. You push the button, but if you push this button, certain things will be injected into your body that will bring about your own suicide." And there's been some court cases about whether he should be involved in murder or not, and I think he got off, as I recall, in the most recent evidence. But a number of people have come to him and said, could I please be connected to your suicide machine? I want to end my life because I've got a terminal illness. I don't want to be a burden to my family. Now, what happens when this becomes one of your own loved ones? What happens if it's you that has consistent pain? What if it's your mate that has that consistent pain? As you recognize, Julie and I have a good relationship. I can't imagine what it would be like if Julie was in pain all the time. And I can't imagine my doing anything to help her end her own life or to encourage people to end her life. But I can understand people who get concerned about a loving mate that they spent their whole lifetime with, who experiences this tremendous pain, or somebody who's got a daughter who's been injured in a car accident has been laying comatose in a hospital bed for 7 or 8 years, and you begin to wonder, is it really worthwhile to keep that plug in that is keeping that person alive? See, these are tremendously controversial issues, and they're not solved easily. I admire our brothers and sisters in the medical profession who have to deal with these every day. But I suggested that these issues are, first of all, complex, and secondly, they are controversial, but thirdly, I suggested that they are cultural. Let me take another example on the list. Discrimination. Might I suggest to you that that is cultural? Who is discriminated against in Australia? You know better than I do. Is there discrimination against Aboriginal people? Is there discrimination against Asian immigrants? Is there discrimination against other people in your culture? From what I read in the newspapers, there is. What about those of you who come from New Zealand? Is there discrimination against the Maori people in your country? Who are the people who are discriminated against there? But let me not point the finger. Who are the people who are discriminated against in Canada, where I grew up? What is the discrimination we have against the Indians? You've read about that in the newspaper. And what about the discrimination that the English-speaking people have against the French? A newspaper in Toronto not long ago said, do you know why the Americans have the problems with blacks and the Canadians have the problems with the French? It's because the Americans got first choice. We got what was left over. And so they're talking about the feelings of the French. But the French have some tremendous discrimination against the English. Did you know that you are not allowed to post any sign in the province of Quebec in any language other than French? One man last Christmas put a sign in his window that said, Merry Christmas, Joyeux Noël. He put Merry Christmas. How do you say it in German? Feliz Navidad in Spanish. And he was arrested. Because you are not supposed to put that in any other language except French. And he was arrested for displaying another language in his own shop. Now, other communities in Canada, small communities thousands of miles from Quebec, have passed laws to say it is illegal to speak French in this community. You see, there is that strong anti-English feeling in Quebec. And as a result, there's a strong anti-French feeling in the rest of the country. So much discrimination that has been there since the time of Confederation and before, that there is a legitimate concern among the people in the country where I grew up, a really serious concern as to whether Canada will survive as a nation until the year 2000. And the whole idea of French secessionist feeling is happening. The last time the Queen was there, she was in Ottawa. And Ottawa, as you may know, is on the other side of the river from Hull, Quebec. So the Queen went across the border into Quebec. The Premier of Quebec, the President, the Mayor of Hull, all of them said, she's not welcome in our province, and we're not going to do anything to meet her. If she wants to come over as a private citizen, I suppose we can't stop her from coming. But there'll be no official receptions. There's got to be no flags. If she comes over, she's on her own as far as we're concerned. Well, that kind of thing is the attitude that is developing. That's discrimination. And what about the United States, where there's tremendous discrimination against blacks? Where we live in the Chicago area, where we live, a lot of discrimination against Mexicans. And there are many, many people coming from Mexico, crossing the border, and coming into the United States. I'm saying this because discrimination is an issue that is cultural. It affects our economics. It very much ties into our educational system. Often it ties into who gets ahead in business. It has great influences in terms of how we feel threatened from other people. I saw something in the newspaper yesterday that was very interesting. It's an article about a lady who has now been appointed, and it says she is on a mission for classroom equality. Did you see this? Eleanor Ramsey is a woman with a mission to eliminate discrimination from the classrooms and from the education department. She is the state's first educational department equity director, the state here in Queensland. Yesterday, she said minority groups were discriminated against from their first day in school. The curriculum content and methodology reflects a world in which men and boys are active and successful, and girls and women are passive and unsuccessful. So, says Ms. Ramsey, many teachers subconsciously pay more attention to boys than to girls' education. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's true. And because boys are more demanding, they get more attention from the teachers, while girls are sitting on the fringes and being told that they're not as important. So this lady says, she says this has a cumulative effect on their self-esteem, on their confidence, and on their future aspirations. And so this lady, appointed yesterday by the education minister, Mr. Brady, this lady has a responsibility for eliminating discrimination in the schools and discriminating in the Department of Education. She said that one teacher in 35 who is male is likely to be appointed a principal of a large school, one out of 35. Would you care to guess how many women get that chance? One out of every 2,000 here in Queensland. I refer to this because I think it's an interesting example of discrimination that is cultural. And here is male-female discrimination, which exists. Today was Secretary's Day. Did you know that? It's interesting how sometimes we discriminate against secretaries. There's a concern at home about harassment of secretaries, including sexual harassment. And secretaries are sometimes treated with disrespect, especially by their male employers. And this is a form of discrimination. Now, if you wonder if you're discriminated, if you are non-biased, and most of us probably think, well, I'm not prejudiced. That's one thing you can say about me. Ask yourself, how would you feel if your son or your daughter came home and said, I am going to marry a... fill in the blank. And you begin to see how painful this can be and how difficult it can be. Would you really be willing to accept that? And that's hard. And also, how would these people fit in your church? How would a mixed marriage fit in your church? How would people who are not of the same race as people fit in your church? See, sometimes discrimination comes into the church too. It is a cultural issue. Now, I have spent a lot of time pointing out that when we talk about these issues on the list, we must recognize that they are complex. We must recognize that they are, whatever else I said, they are controversial. And we must recognize that they are cultural. Now, where has this left me? Obviously, it would be wrong, given this, for me to try to deal with each of these issues on the list and give a concise answer of how to deal with them. So maybe what we need to do, and I talked to the committee, and this was their understanding, not that we'd solve all these problems in one evening, of course that's not going to happen, but that we would instead use these topics, these significant topics, as a springboard for us to think about what do we take away from this conference. One of the things we have to recognize is that these are the very people that Christian People Helpers are concerned about. These are the people that we want to deal with. These are the people that Jesus would be dealing with if he was around today, living on earth like he did when he walked the earth so many years ago. And so I would like to, instead of giving answers which I'm afraid would be simplistic and maybe simple, I would like to use these topics to challenge all of us to be more effective and to be more creative in our people-helping activities so that as we go from this conference, we go out encouraged, we go out enthusiastic about finding ways that we can deal with these social issues and maybe show the world and show our culture some creative ways to deal with these things. Now, in each of the talks that I've given here, you may recognize that I have come up with three or four words or three or four topics in my outline. Would I change in the end? No. So I've got four topics I want to deal with. All of this has just been introduction. Now I'm going to get going. The four, and I'm going to build this around four words. Number one is paradigms. That's a technical word. P-A-R-A-D-I-G-M-S. Number one, paradigms. Number two, community. Number three, education. And number four, conclusions. Let's look at each of these in turn. Number one, paradigms. This morning, Julie and I went for a walk. That's how we found out the real meaning of the Holy Spirit parking lot. And as we're walking down, those of you who are visiting tonight for the first time will wonder what that's all about, but let me not explain it at this point. There's a Holy Spirit parking lot in Brisbane. I can hardly wait to go back and tell people that. As we were walking down the street, we passed a mailbox, and I'd never seen this before. I bet Julie didn't even notice it. It was a very small mailbox. It had the number of the place, and underneath it said in these letters about an inch high, no junk mail. And I thought to myself, I can't believe it. They've got junk mail in Australia. I thought we were the only people who had junk mail. When I get back, I told somebody today I was going to send them some information, but I said, don't expect me to get it to you the first day, because I'll probably walk into my little office and I will sit down and the desk will be piled this high with mail. I've got somebody going through it and taking out some of the junk mail, but there'll be a lot of stuff there that has accumulated during my absence. Well, sometimes, however, the so-called junk mail contains some gems. I got one of these about 2 months ago. It was a newsletter that I almost pushed aside. It was from a mission organization, and it was you know, one of these publications that are good, that are useful, but that I just don't have the time to read. So I skimmed through this thing, and I came across this little column written by a man. I don't even know why I started to read it, but he started talking about Moses, and Moses being out in the wilderness at about the time he was leading the children of Israel at the beginning of their wilderness wandering. And he talked about the fact that Moses sent 12 people as spies into the promised land. And they were told to go in and have a look. Moses sent them on a mission. See what the land is like. This is recorded in Numbers 13. See what the land is like, whether or not the people who live there are strong or weak, few or many, and what kind of a land they live in. Good research questions. So off went these 12 brave souls into the land. And then they came back. And they said to Moses, we come back united. We all agree with what we saw. The people are very big. The land is flowing with milk and honey. The people are very strong, stronger than we are. And really, comparing ourselves to them, we look like grasshoppers compared to them. This was the facts. They all had the same facts. But what was interesting, they looked at the facts in different ways. 10 of them said, the land is so big, and the people are so huge, and the opposition is so great, there is no way, Moses, that we're going to defeat them. But two of the people, Caleb and Joshua, said, oh, we agree with the facts, but we look at the facts in an entirely different way. Moses, yes, these people are big. Yes, we're small in comparison, but Moses, think in a different way. We've got God on our side. We can go in and we can wipe out those people very quickly. Let's do it in the morning and get it over with. Now, these people had the same facts, but different ways of looking at the facts. Now, when psychologists and sociologists and other people talk about paradigms, that is a fancy word for the way we perceive the world and the way we perceive facts. We all have ways of perceiving the world. Yesterday, I was talking about the presuppositions that the Christian brings to counseling. I could have said the paradigm that the Christian brings to counseling. Because the perspective that the Christian brings to counseling, we as Christians bring a unique perspective to counseling. Now, in this experience that Moses encountered, two of the people had one perspective, and 10 of the people had a different perspective. And you remember what happened. Moses went along with the 10, and was sorry later that he did this. Now, each of us has perspectives on social issues. And some of those perspectives have a bearing on how we view social issues. We each have what might be called a paradigm, or somebody has said certain kinds of glasses through which we view the world around us. And sometimes we look at the world in one way and fail to see it in any other way. On the way over here, we stopped in California for a couple of days, and I met with a man who was a psychologist. Marvelous guy. I really like this guy. And we were talking about some creative things we were doing, but he could only see these things being done within the confines of the organization with which he works. And I said, Ken, break out of that. There are other ways that we can solve this problem. Don't box yourself in. See, the box was his paradigm, was his way of looking at things. And I am suggesting to you that we have got to change our way of looking at social issues. This article that I read in the midst of my junk mail described a young man who took over from his father in a company that manufactured drill bits. For 40 years, they had been measuring drill bits. That's the part that goes on the end of the drill and makes the hole. The son of the founder attended his first staff meeting as the new president after his father had died. And the son said to the men around the table, "What business are we in?" The older man, who had served many years alongside his father, kind of looked down on him and said, "What business are we in? We've served alongside your father for many years. We make drill bits," came the slightly exasperated reply. "Our customers need drill bits." "No, they don't," said the young man, the president of the company. "Our customers need holes. And you can make holes in a variety of ways. And the reason the company is going down is because we have stuck with the drill bits. Let's see new ways to make holes." And they became a leader in laser ways of cutting through and making precise holes. The son had a different paradigm. He had a different way of viewing things. I wonder if sometimes our way of viewing things is too narrow. Several years ago, a man by the name of Thomas Kuhn published a book that some of you who are sociologically alert may have read, or some of you who are scientists may have read. And he said, all scientific advances come about because of paradigm shifts. We are thinking in one way, and all of a sudden somebody comes along with a different way of thinking. Usually it's a young person who comes along with a different way of thinking. The older people consider this person a young rebel. This young rebel challenges the existing world, challenges the way the world has been doing things, and gets ostracized, and then everybody comes along later and says, you know, the young rebel was right. I mentioned Bill Hybels earlier today. Bill Hybels was one of those people. He had a youth program, and it was an exciting youth program. He said, we got to change the music. We got to change the format. He went around and knocked on doors for 1 month in a community and said to people, why don't you go to church? And they said, because it's boring, because it's irrelevant, and because they're always asking for money. So Bill Hybels said, let's start a church that is not boring. It's never going to be boring. It's never going to be irrelevant. It's always going to be relevant, and we're not going to beg for money. You go to that church, and they say, we're going to take up the offering, and this is for the people who are here tonight. They're the people who attend regularly. If you're a visitor, this part of the service is not for you. Please don't participate at this time. We want you to be our guests. Now, maybe we don't hear that too often. Maybe you hear that all the time in churches in Australia. We sure don't hear that at home. And he was a young man who came across with a new way of looking at things. Now, you can obviously see where I'm going. Alan Topher, whom I mentioned today, says we've got to recognize that there are shifts in power in the culture. Maybe we've got to recognize the people who were powerful before might not be powerful in the future. Maybe politicians who were more powerful in the past won't be powerful in the future. Maybe it's the people with education and the people who've got facts that are going to be more powerful in the days that are coming. Peter Drucker, who, as you know, is a writer in terms of especially business, came out with a new book about a year ago. I've got it. I've read partway through it. And he says we need to have paradigm shifts in politics, new ways of looking at economics, and new ways of looking at business. Leslie Newbegin, who, as you may recognize, is a bishop, I believe he's in India, he says we need some theology paradigm shifts, looking at things differently, theologically. And then along comes this man who wrote this article that I referred to. He says we've got to have some new paradigm shifts in missions. We can't do missions the way we did in the past. We've got to think of some new ways. Now, why am I spending all my time talking about this? Because I suggest to you that we as Christians, followers of Jesus Christ, people who are growing in our relationship with Christ, hopefully, people who spend time in the Scriptures, people who are seeking the Holy Spirit's guidance and work in our lives, and we emphasize this, as this man does in the article, we might need to say, Lord, we're stuck. We don't know what to do about pornography. We don't really know what to do about euthanasia. We really don't know what to do about the increasing suicide rate, even though we have some people here who are making significant contributions in all of this. Maybe we need to recognize that we have been so set in some of our ways of dealing with people that maybe we've got to break out from some of this. Now, how are we going to break out? Let me give you some examples. There is a new field developing called brief counseling. And it is suggesting that you can't have people come now and sit in a room week after week after week in terms of counseling. For one thing, their employers won't let them off for that. For another thing, insurance companies won't pay for that. For another thing, people aren't going to put up with that. And furthermore, it's been discovered that brief counseling can often be very effective. And we don't always need the long-term stuff. That's very interesting. Now, be careful. Some people need that long-term counseling. Brief counseling is a new way of looking at counseling. Or what about the whole idea of use of computers in counseling? Now, you're not going to turn somebody loose and have a computer counsel them. Although some people have designed programs that are trying to do that. Now, what about computers in self-directed testing and assessment? What about computers in teaching people certain kinds of skills? What about computers in teaching people problem-solving techniques? What about the use of computers to supplement your counseling in career guidance? What about computers in personal counseling? Somebody has suggested that this is one of the most controversial issues in mental health. We talked about some things in this conference that I think represent paradigm shifts. Let's get lay people more involved than they were involved. It's interesting for me to see what it means to be a psychologist in this country. Do you know that in the country where I live, you cannot call yourself a psychologist? You cannot use that term unless you have a PhD or equivalent doctoral degree, unless you have a certain number of hours of supervision, unless you have passed state licensing examinations. You cannot call yourself a psychologist, and if you call yourself a psychologist without those qualifications, you can be legally prosecuted. Now, you are ahead of us on that then. And the people can use that term when you don't have that type of requirements you have to step through. But what about the use of lay counselors? What about the use of media in counseling? Maybe some of these people we're trying to reach, we can only get them through television or through the media because we're not going to get them in any other way. What about the use of environmental change? We haven't said much about environmental counseling. Sometimes people get involved in pornography, they get involved in discrimination, they get involved in sexual harassment because of the environments in which they live and work. Have you ever thought of people helping being so simple as to change people and pull them out of poverty situations? To pull them out of situations where they are abused and harassed? See, those are things where we need to recognize that's not counseling, sitting down, nodding your head and saying, mm-hmm. That may be involved in cleaning up a neighborhood. It may be involved in getting your church out, involved in social issues that psychologists, at least, and professional counselors have not been very much involved in. And I'm suggesting that maybe we need to shift the way we think about counseling. Not too long ago at home, a man looked around him and he thought, what about people who have mental illness and they have to go to the hospital? And they want to go to a Christian hospital. Where do they go? There are, to my knowledge, two or three Christian psychiatric hospitals at home, but they're spread out and they're expensive. This man thought, why don't we go to the general hospitals throughout the country and we'll set up a Christian psychiatric treatment ward in the general hospital. We'll bring a Christian treatment program, we'll bring Christian psychiatrists and Christian psychologists and Christian nurses, we'll bring a whole Christian staff, and we'll have a program geared towards Christians. Can you imagine how the people in the community responded to that? With all kinds of resistance. But they finally got into one hospital, and then into another, and then into another. They have a program, it's called the RAPHA program, R-A-P-H-A. R-A-P-H-A, that's the Hebrew word I'm told for healing. I know about it because I'm on their national board of consultants. They have four psychiatrists and one psychologist, which is me. And we meet together and talk about how RAPHA can be doing a more effective job. And RAPHA is not the only organization. There are probably five or six organizations now at home, and these Christian psychiatric wards are springing up all over the country. Who would have thought about that 3 or 4 years ago? That's a paradigm shift. That's a way of thinking. We're going to approach things in a new way. It's an innovative way. What about developing some prevention models? What about the whole issue? How are we going to respond to Satanism? How are we going to respond to the cultists? How are we going to respond to the widespread belief in our culture in astrology and UFOs and extrasensory perception? I don't think people are going to come and listen to a lecture in our congregation. And I don't think they're going to come and sit in our counseling offices while we go through the counseling techniques that you've read about in a book called How to Be a People Helper. Fine as that book may be. See, I think we need to think of some creative ways. And that means sitting down, maybe, and brainstorming. Maybe that means letting your creative juices flow and come up with ideas and think, oh, that won't work. Well, maybe it might work. I suspect that when people first thought about having this conference, somebody probably sat down and said, we'll never pull this off. Maybe nobody will come. This is never going to work. And yet the world is filled with innovative approaches that people thought would never work. And when I don't know about you, but as I get older, I want to keep on the cutting edge of these things. I want to be with stimulating, creative people who are thinking in new ways. I want to see people who are willing to try something new. And maybe we've got to try some new ways. I'm not going to tell you how to do it because I don't know. But some new ways to deal with these social problems. Ways that we've never thought about before, but ways that just might work, like that midnight basketball league that has taken down crime in the inner city of Chicago. That's an innovative cultural shift. It's a paradigm shift. Well, I said there were four words. The first word is paradigm. The second word is community. About a year ago, the Journal of Mental Health Counseling published an article on mental health counseling education in Australia. The author came to Australia and spent 4 months going throughout the country visiting training institutions. And in his article, he was very positive about Australia, for which I was grateful, very positive about what was going on here. But it was interesting, he said, I've noticed in Australia that much of the training and much of the people helping is on the pathology model. They look at people who've got problems and try to deal with them like a doctor would deal with somebody who is sick. They said there's very little emphasis on environmental interventions. There is very little emphasis on identifying and mobilizing client assets. And there is very little emphasis on helping people through the process of normal human development. That doesn't seem to be done very much. And then he said, but Australia seems to be, and these are his words because I could never write like this with such a tongue twister. He says, Australia has a tempestuous movement towards multiculturalism. Wow. But he says, but even though there is this strong multiculturalism in this country, maybe as much as any place in the world, something that gives your culture much of its vitality and much of its excitement, he says sometimes the counseling seems to be kind of bogged down in the Avis kind of stuff. Now, there is community counseling in Australia. I picked that up. There are people moving out with innovative approaches to people helping. But we come back to the lay counseling, back to the media counseling, back to the cross-cultural counseling that I have hardly mentioned, it's hardly come up, back to maybe being involved in working with other segments of society, people who are educators, people who are politicians, people who are religious leaders, people who are community leaders, people maybe who are involved in the Lions Club that is going to invade Brisbane in the latter part of June. Did you know about that? What, 30,000 did I read? How many? 45. But they're going to bring a lot of money into the economy, right? The Lions Club, I don't know if you know this, is not just a group of men who get together and socialize and go on conferences. The Lions Club is a club of people worldwide that have concerns about people. They're concerned about the blind. And I know about them because the Lions Club, worldwide, has become strong advocates of programs for dealing with drugs in kids. And they have developed some creative, innovative, anti-drug programs. See, here is a community organization that is concerned about substance abuse, especially among teenagers. And I'm not giving any kind of endorsement to the Lions. I don't know that much about them, except to say that there are community clubs like that who might be people that you have to work alongside. And that is a paradigm shift. Now, this idea then of moving into cultures, getting involved with the culture, we've got to do that if we're going to be effective in counseling. Please don't continue sitting in your offices waiting for people to come to you. Yes, some of that is necessary, but we've got to go beyond that. And that's getting into the community. And if there's an innovative approach that's coming in, I think, in counseling in the years ahead, it's going to be community psychology and community psychiatry and community counseling. Word number three. The first is paradigm. The second is community. The third is education. I've talked to several people here who are educators. And I am convinced, as I said before, that much of what we have to do is to be involved in education. Now, there are various approaches to education. You've seen some of them here. You've seen some role plays in your seminars. You've seen some behavior rehearsals. You've seen teaching people to develop certain kinds of skills. You've taught people how to view problems in different ways. That's a technique that is basically educational, because many times our problems come because we view a problem one way and we've got to learn to perceive it in a different way, and that's education. Much of counseling involves learning, training people in interpersonal relations. That becomes very important. It seems to me that we've got to develop what somebody has called a competency model, which trains people to be competent. And that has got to become more and more important and more prominent than the sickness model that trains people to get well. And I'm not putting that down. I'm saying we've got to go beyond the sickness model to develop a competency model. Several people have come to me during the course of this conference and said, we appreciate some of the things that you are saying, Gary, but how do we apply this educationally within our churches, within our communities, within our training programs? Have you ever thought how Jesus trained people helpers? It isn't quite stated in those words, but it's there. And I suggest to you that Jesus has a model of people helper training. It's found in the book of Luke. And it's found in the 9th chapter of Luke. Jesus gets together and he calls the 12 together. And notice what he did. First, he empowered them. He gave them power and authority to drive out demons and to cure diseases. And incidentally, he gave them two goals. He said, I want you to go out to preach the kingdom and to heal. See, preaching was very important on probably with a whole group of people. But healing on a more one-to-one basis was also important. So what we are doing if we are presenting a message on a Sunday morning, like Dr. Stephen Alford talked about in that question today, that's important. That's preaching. Jesus authorized that. We cannot ignore that. But he also talked about healing. Might that be a one-to-one people helping kind of thing? And Jesus begins by giving these people power to go out. Let us recognize that we're not going to be very effective people helpers if we do things in our own strength. That's why this morning I emphasize this whole importance of where we are in our relationship with God. Jesus empowered them. He gave them authority and power. Secondly, He educated them. Here's where the education comes in. We see this in verse 2 and 4. He sent them out to preach the kingdom and to heal the sick. There's the twofold thrust. And He told them, here's the education. He told them, take no bag for the journey, no staff, no bread, no money, no extra tunic, and whatever house you enter, stay there until you leave that town. Now notice that Jesus is giving instruction. I'm going to tell you what to do. But secondly, Jesus gave them warning. If people don't welcome you, then shake the dust off your feet when you leave the town as a testimony against them. I want to tell you, fellas, they're not always going to accept them. Let me warn you on that. So He gives them instruction. That's part of the education. He gives them warning. That's part of the education. And then He gives them experience. That's part of the education. So they went out from village to village, preaching the gospel and healing people everywhere. Notice what Jesus did? He empowered them. And then He educated them by instruction, by giving them warning, and by giving them experience. What a beautiful model of training people. But there's more. Jesus encouraged them. Now, I'm going to argue a little bit from silence here, and I recognize that's not a good hermeneutical principle. Because it doesn't say here that He encouraged them. But it does say that when they came back, verse 10, they reported to Jesus what they had done, and He took them with Him, and they withdrew by themselves to a town called Bethesda. I wonder what they did there. If you slip over, is it Luke chapter 10, verse 17? That's what I've got written down here. At one time, Jesus sent out the 70. I may have the wrong reference here. But He sent out the 72 people. And when they came back, Jesus said, I want to tell you, I've been watching. I've been watching how the forces of Satan have been falling in response to what you've been doing. He said that when the 72 went out. We read that in Luke chapter 10. I wonder if He did this in Luke chapter 9 too. And He said, fellas, hey, you've been doing a great job. And I want to encourage you in what you've been doing. And I think Jesus showed His encouragement to these people. And maybe that's a principle of our educating people. We need to empower them and let them see where their power comes from. We need to educate them, and then we need to encourage them. But then notice what Jesus did, chapter 9, verse 11. But the crowds learned about where they were and followed them. And you know what He did? He welcomed them and spoke to them about the kingdom of heaven, preaching, and healed those who needed healing. See, Jesus did one other thing. He exemplified. He was a model for them to follow. And here was an example of training. So this is sort of a four-part model of training that Jesus used in preparing the disciples. Couldn't we use this in preparing people helpers here in Queensland? Couldn't we empower them? This word empowerment sometimes is a catchword in the literature. But what I'm suggesting is that we instill people with confidence, instill them with a recognition that they can go out and can be used by God. Somebody in an article that I recently read said, the message of Jesus was that He had come to empower others to have an abundant life. Jesus provided an empowerment model. Jesus rejected the use of power to control others, but He affirmed instead the use of power to serve others, to lift up the fallen, to forgive the guilty, to encourage responsibility and maturity in the weak, and to empower the powerless. And we come to people and say, your job is to go out in the strength of the Lord and empower other people. Just as God has worked in your life, you are to go out and watch Him as He works through you in the lives of other people. What a mind-boggling idea. And Jesus empowered people. We can empower the people we're trying to train. And we can educate them. That's a crucial part of counseling. That's what's been going on here for the last 2.5 days. And we've done it by instruction. That's cognitive. We've done it by giving people experiences to do, at sometimes homework. That's certainly behavior, attitude. And we've also given them modeling. And some of them have watched one another. And they look at us and they begin to see, well, okay, the model is not perfect. But nevertheless, it's somebody that is an example for us. So here is ways we can use. We can give instruction. We can give experience. We can give modeling. But we can not only be empowering people, not only educating people, we can also be encouraging people. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 25, talks about the fact that we should encourage one another. I was talking to a young man the other day. He said, I go to a Christian college. I go to chapel every day at this Christian college. And he said, you know, I've discovered something. Every day, it seems, we go in and we have a different speaker who gets up and complains about something we're not doing right or pushes us. I wish somebody, sometime, would get up and encourage us. I mentioned that Julie and I work with a group of young adults. Marvelous people. Good people. They're praying for us, as I mentioned, while we're traveling. And I challenge them. I push them. Because I want to push them, because I think that will keep them moving in their spiritual walk. But I spend a lot of time encouraging them, too. Because these people don't need to be clobbered their whole lives. They need some people to come along and say, hey, I know it's not easy where you are. I know you're struggling. I can say that to you. I know there are some of you who are the only counselor in your whole town. I know that some of you are far away from any support, any encouragement. I know that some of you are going away from this conference and you think it's been like being in an oasis in the middle of the desert. I love it. I hate to have to go back now to all the struggles. But maybe we can go forth from this place encouraged that there are other people who care, other people who have the same concerns we do, and other people who can encourage us as we go forth from this place. Encouragement's a part of training. And then, of course, being an example is part of training. And a lot of what we do as we train other people depends on who we are. And if you want to work with people who've got AIDS, and you want to work with people who are poor, and you want to work with people who are powerless in the society, and you want to work with people who are discriminated against, or whose sexual behavior is deviant in some way, a lot of what you do as a leader, how you model that kind of compassionate behavior, people follow a model. And I think one of the things that Jesus did over and over again was to be a good model. So if we're going to be dealing with these social issues that we've got on our list tonight, it seems to me that we've got to think of new, creative, innovative ways. That's the paradigm. We've got to get out into the community and take our counseling out into the community. That's the community word. We've got to be concerned about educating people. That's the education word. There was one more, wasn't there? And that's the word observations. And these are sort of my observations as we come to the end. You have been very gracious in that you've given me a lot of time to stand up here. I have been blessed beyond measure in the chance to be able to interact with you and to share some of my ideas. And some of you have been here all seven sessions. And the four B's are probably getting to you about now. And you recognize that we're coming to the end and you probably hope that it will not be long and that we'll still be able to hang on. Let me just make a few observations. You know how we feel. I was telling some of the committee people tonight. I said, we've had a marvelous trip to Australia. You know that. I couldn't pretend that we like Australia if we didn't really like Australia. And I hope you've picked up the enthusiasm that Julie and I both have had. But several things I think are worth considering. Number one, I think you have a healthy interest in people helping. You have a healthy interest in caring. And you have a healthy interest in training. And I think that is an exciting interest that you have. And as I've listened to the questions and interacted with you, I've seen a healthy balance here too. And I think that's good. And I applaud you for that balance and that healthiness and that interest. As I've said before, it's going to be interesting to see how God works in your lives. And I have that sense, as many people here do because you've expressed it, that this is going to be the start of something big, maybe something more than any of us could dare imagine tonight. As we see the Lord work through people here. And some of you may think, who am I? I'm a nobody. And yet the Lord works through people who are the most unlikely people. Think about that. And He may work through some people here who think, well, I'm just sitting here listening. He may work through a number of people to bring about significant changes in the whole climate of Queensland, New South Wales, and the rest of Australia. And that's something that I've observed and I'm excited about. A healthy interest and a healthy balance. The second thing I've noticed is a willingness to learn. Where else would we find an audience that sits here on the second night you've been here since 10:30 this morning, 10 o'clock this morning, and all day yesterday, and part of the day before, and some of you traveled a lot the day before, and you've got to get up tomorrow morning and travel long hours to go back, and yet you have been here incredibly attentive. people who are willing to learn, but I also recognize people who are willing to be innovative, people who are willing to try new things, and I suspect people who are going to run with these paradigm shifts and come up with some creative ideas. There's a lot of creative juices flowing here, and some of them may have been flowing in the last hour or two. Creative juices that I think are going to be seen in fruit that comes in the future. You have a tremendous willingness to learn. I am convinced that if we stop learning, we stop growing. I never want to be a guy that stops learning. Somebody made the comment to my wife, he reads a lot, doesn't he? Yeah, I read a lot. I read too much. But I'm trying to keep aware of what's going on. And I'm not suggesting that you should read a lot. Some of you, your jobs are such you hardly have time to pick up a newspaper. You haven't got time to look at anything because of that. I can understand that. But to me, I try to read a lot because I don't want to be a guy who gets to be 60 or 70 or 80 or 90 and has dried out. I would like to be aware of what's going on. I was talking to a man the other day, and he says, I'm in my middle 50s. He said, we don't have much time. I said, well, I'm in my middle 50s too, and I've only got about another 30 or 35 years. So I've got to do something now in the time that is ahead. Well, all right. Continue to keep learning. You are people who are learning. The mere fact that you are here is an example of this. Keep learning, brothers and sisters, and I think you're going to keep growing. Thirdly, you are people who have a love-hate relationship, I think, with some of your churches. I've picked that up. You know there are hurting people in your churches. You know that there are people in your churches who are homosexual, people who have mental illness, and you sometimes don't know what to do with them. You forget sometimes that those people take a long time to heal. If some of those people had surgery, they had open-heart surgery, you would expect that it would take a while for them to heal, wouldn't you? But if those people get a major depression or have a schizophrenic break, you sometimes respond, I gather, maybe not you here, but some of the people in the churches we represent, they think, well, what's the matter with you? Quick, snap out of it. Let the Holy Spirit work in your life and take away that problem immediately. And some people discover that just like physical problems take a long time to heal, so do psychological problems. So do spiritual problems take a long time to heal. A lot of people among us are wounded. Now, have you thought of people in the Bible who were wounded and took a long time to heal? Think about Peter. It took a long time before Peter, they called him the rock. But he was pretty impulsive. He's the only disciple that got out of the boat in the middle of a lake. Think about it. He's the disciple that was whipping the sword around in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's the disciple that denied Jesus. He's the disciple supposed to be a follower of the Lord who starts to curse and swear. He's the disciple who wondered if God would ever give him a second chance. And he's the disciple who wrote part of the epistles and the disciple who was made a significant contribution in the life of the church, but it took him a long time to get there. He didn't change immediately. Or think about John Mark. I've been reading about him recently, remember? I kind of like that guy, because off he went on the first missionary trip, and he got homesick, and he decided to go home. He left them. So the second time, they have another trip, and he wants to go again, and Paul says, no way, he's a quitter. And here's John Mark. What happens? He goes off with somebody else, and you get to the end of the book, the New Testament, and Paul is saying, send Mark to me. He's useful for me in the gospel. And it never dawned on me. I must have been awfully dense. But it never dawned on me until a couple of months ago that it's the same John Mark, the same guy that wrote the second of the Gospels. And here is this guy who blew it so many times, it took him a long time to get better. Well, what about Timothy? Timothy, somebody said, remember Timothy? He took a little wine for his stomach's sake. Now, I don't know where some of you stand on this. I think among Baptists, they think the Greek word means he took a little grape juice for his stomach's sake. But whatever he took, this guy was sick. Why didn't Paul heal him? Why didn't Paul pray that he'd get better like that? Well, Paul probably did. But he still had the stomach problem. And maybe it existed for a long time. I wonder if that served a useful purpose. In fact, while we're talking about Paul, what about Paul himself? He said, I've got a thorn in the flesh. I keep praying it'll go away, and it doesn't go away. And he said, I'm weak, but when I'm weak, then I'm strong. And sometimes we expect everybody in the church to be strong.
And we expect all of our numbers here to be strong. We expect every counselor to be strong. We expect ourselves to be strong. But Jesus said, but the scriptures say, look, be careful. When you are weak, then you are strong. Paul Tournier wrote a book many years ago called The Strong and the Weak. And he said, we divide people into two categories, the strong people and the weak people. But he said, you know, if you're really honest, we're all weak people. And God uses weak people. Have you ever thought of that? And He uses people like you and me. But sometimes in our churches, we set up standards that people can't live up to. And we forget that when people struggle, and when they struggle psychologically, and struggle spiritually, and struggle physically, maybe there's a process of growth going on. And we must be very careful that we don't push those people to have a quick turnaround, because often that quick turnaround doesn't come. We need to show that kind of compassion. We need to have that patience. In due time we will reap if we do not grow weary, but sometimes it takes a while. And we need to look at our churches and recognize our churches are not perfect. We've got to change our format, perhaps. Maybe we've got to change our music. Maybe we need some paradigm shifts in the church. But I still remember our first Sunday in Australia on this trip. We were in Melbourne, and we said to our host there, tell us, where's a good church to go to in Melbourne? A church that is really cutting edge, that's really reaching the people. We'd like to go to that church and see what's happening in Australia. And our host said, forget it. There isn't one of those in Melbourne. Now, I don't know if that's right. But even if it isn't, it's sad that that's the perception of the church. And the more I think of it, the more I'm convinced that if we're going to make an impact, including on these social issues, a lot of that impact is going to have to come through the local church. And I think instead of our criticism of the local church, we need to be building up the local church. Instead of criticizing the pastors, maybe we've got to be building up the pastors. We've got to be putting our emphasis on training lay people, training those seminary students, some of those college students, some of the theological students who are here. Yes, maybe some of them were expected to come. But others have come voluntarily, and whatever their motivation for coming, these are the people who are going to be on the cutting edges in the future, and the university students who are here. Those are the people we need to be pouring ourselves into, those people. I was talking to a man today about how do we take counseling to other cultures, and I said, well, it seems to me one of the things you need to do is to learn the culture. And that's not just if you're going to another country. You learn that if you're going to reach the homeless. You learn that if you're going to reach the poor. You learn that if you're going to reach victims of AIDS. You learn that if you're going to reach people who are dying. You need to learn what's going on in those people. You learn that culture. And then you try to adapt your approaches to that culture in which you are going. And along the way, you try to train other people who are in that culture to carry on the work. One of the exciting things about me in this conference is that there are people here who are going to pick up and carry on from here. See, there's nothing worse than a conference that goes excitingly for 2 or 3 days and then comes to a mighty grand halt. Bang, it's done. But I don't think that's going to happen here, because I can see a lot of enthusiasm and excitement. And I suspect those of you who maybe haven't got any creative ideas yet, maybe you're not creative people. Watch your mailbox. And it might just not be junk mail that comes from some of the people who've worked in this conference and who are thinking of creative ways to keep going what has been started here. But I think many times we're going to have to recognize the importance of working in and through the local church. I have noticed, number four, that you have a sense of isolation. Not so much a sense of isolation as Australia cut off from the rest of the world, because I sense that that's changing, especially as we have open communication along the way, especially as we can fly back and forth so quickly, especially as so many Australians travel. But you have a different kind of isolation. Some of you feel isolated geographically, but some of you have a professional isolation. You may be around a lot of other people, but you think, I don't have any other professionals I can talk to. I've talked to people here who've said, I'm in my own profession, I don't know any other Christians in my profession. Or I know the work that I'm in, but how do I learn about Christian counseling? I don't know how to tie that in. Or I'm in the pastorate, how do I understand about counseling and counseling issues? And this is a sense of isolation, which I guess concerns me, and I think that's something we need to work on, and I know something you are working on, something that I'm going to be giving a lot of thought to as I go back home. How do we deal with people who are isolated, but whose hearts are in the right place, and who want not to be isolated? There are some things being done, but I think that's significant. One other observation.
You are people who must remember, I suggest, that we are in a spiritual battle. Now, that's come up before, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But I think the devil is very interested in tripping you up. Remember the parable of the sower? I suspect the devil is out there tonight trying to take away the seed that has been sown in some of our creative minds over these last few days. As you know, I make a number of these trips, maybe 3 or 4 or sometimes 5 every year. And Julie and I have been interested to watch what happens. Almost every trip we go on, we see something that at least appears to us to be something which is satanic. Something that kind of hits us, that clobbers us before we get on the trip or sometimes while we're on the trip. A couple of years ago, I was in Japan. I don't think I have ever been so sick from food poisoning in my entire life. Never happened before or since. Well, maybe it was coincidental. But it was interesting, the timing. On our trip to Australia last year, we got a letter from one of our kids to tell us she was going to marry a non-Christian. Subsequently, she said, no, that wasn't right. And I don't know what I was thinking about, why I made that decision. But can you imagine, we're ready to get on a plane to go away 2 days before we get this letter. And she said, oh, incidentally, I'm going to marry a non-Christian in a couple of months. We're going to get married in the courthouse because he doesn't want anybody to talk about Christian things. And he's agreed that we won't talk about anything Christian after we get married. Can you imagine how that would throw us? And so we said to our friends, look, would you please pray for our daughter? People prayed, and I think ultimately a lot of good has come from this. Now, she still sees the guy, but she says, that would have been wrong. She says, I've learned some things through coming through that experience. But why did that happen 2 days before we go on a trip? I will not share with you what happened on this trip. But I will tell you, it really threw Julie and me for a few days and continues to throw us. We've had these things happen. Have you noticed that when you're involved in ministry? The devil exists. And he's out to create problems and havoc. And there's why we need one another to pray for one another. And we need to be concerned about one another. And don't forget, brothers and sisters, that you are in a battle. And don't run ahead on your creativity with so much enthusiasm that you run ahead of the Lord. Or you forget the fact that we need His guidance in all of the things we do. Because we have an enemy that is a lot stronger than we are. And especially when we deal with these difficult social issues, we find ourselves in some real difficulties if we are not aware of the satanic elements in the society. Well, our time is just about gone. Let me share with you right at the end one other reference to Scripture. Don't even take the time to turn to it unless you feel like it. I'd like to tell you about a hero of mine. And I was thinking tonight, it seems to me that I close almost every conference by referring to the same guy. That didn't dawn on me until tonight, between the afternoon session and this evening session. But I really like this guy. I don't think he was a counselor, but he was a model that I would hope my life would follow. And the man's name is Daniel. Remember Daniel? Daniel was one of those people who came out of the land of Jerusalem. He came from Jerusalem. He was taken in the Babylonian captivity over to as part of Nebuchadnezzar's captives, taken over to the land of Babylon, and he was a kid. Some people have estimated that maybe he was 14 when this happened. And you notice what Daniel did with his life? In the first place, Daniel took care of his body. The king came along and said, we're going to give all these new kids, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, some other people, we're going to give them the best of the food we have in the new land. And Daniel said, wait a minute. I don't want to defile myself with the king's food. Why don't I have the good food like we had before? Not the royal food and wine, but healthy food. And you remember the story of how Daniel and his colleagues ate that good food, and they were healthier than the people who took the king's food and wine. Daniel took care of his body. Don't forget that, brothers and sisters, if you are concerned about people helping. Watch out for your rest. Watch out for what you eat. Watch out for your exercise. How basic, how simple, how easily forgotten. Remember that we have bodies that aren't perfect. We have a responsibility to take care of them if we're going to be good people helpers. But Daniel also took care of his mind. Chapter 1, verse 17. To these four men, Daniel and his three people, colleagues. God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. Here's Daniel understanding what was going on. Don't let your mind stop growing. If you're concerned about these social issues that are around, keep reading about them. Keep trying to understand them. A new book by Jack Balswick and somebody else deals with social problems. It just came out about 6 months ago, written from an evangelical perspective. A good book to help you understand the dynamics of these social problems. I try to read about them and try to keep up on them. If you're working in these areas, inform yourself on these areas. Daniel understood what was going on. He used his mind. Please don't turn off your mind if you want to be a people helper. But Daniel took care of his ego. The king came along and said, I've had a dream, and somebody's come through and interpret the dream. Well, everybody said, oh yeah, we can interpret dreams. Which goes to show, sometimes I think dream interpretation is more the fantasy of the interpreter than it is what's coming out of the dreamer. But Daniel, nevertheless, said, well, okay, I can interpret your dream. But the king says, oh yes, there's one little thing. You have to tell me what the dream was. If you can't tell me what the dream was, I don't believe your interpretation. Well, of course, nobody could do it, but Daniel could. You know why? Because God revealed to Daniel what the dream was all about. We see this in the second chapter. And the king said, anybody who can't interpret the dream, off with their head, literally. So Daniel goes in, and the king says in chapter 2, verse 26, are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it? And Daniel could have said, oh yeah, king, you got the right man, it's me. But Daniel says, no wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked for. None of us can do that. We're not smart enough. But God, there's a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the days to come. Your dream and your visions that pass through your mind as you lay on your bed are these. Daniel said, it's not me, king, it's God. Here is Daniel taking care of his ego. Daniel is a humble man. If you want to be an effective people helper, if you want to deal with these social problems around, train yourself to be somebody who recognizes that it's God working through you. And humility becomes a mark of an effective people helper. Well, then you know the stories that intervene. We get over to chapter 6. And some of the people get jealous because Daniel has now risen to a high position in the government. And they say, we're going to have to find out something wrong with him. He's a politician. He's probably got his hand in the till. He's probably doing something that's not correct. So it says in chapter 6, they try to find out what's wrong with Daniel. And listen to this. Chapter 6, verse 4, they could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. What a marvelous testimony to this man. See, Daniel took care of his body. He took care of his mind. Daniel took care of his ego and he took care of his work. He did the best job he could with the gifts and the opportunities that God had given to him. I want to be a person who strives for excellence in what I do, in everything that I do. And if we can be those kinds of people, then God uses us to reach out and to deal with those difficulties that we have in our society. But one other thing about Daniel. You remember the people said, well, we can't find anything wrong with him. The only way we're going to get to Daniel, it's got to have something to do with the law of his God. Chapter 6, verse 5. And so the men said, all right, what we'll do, we'll get the king, we'll play on the king's ego. And we'll say, okay, king, why don't you have everybody bow down and worship you? And if they don't do it, we'll chuck them into a den of lions. And Daniel hears this decree. And it's interesting what Daniel did. Now when Daniel, verse 10 of chapter 6, learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem, and three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God just as he had done before. Daniel didn't go off to some kind of a closet and hide. Daniel didn't keep his Christianity hidden. Daniel took care of his spiritual life, just as he had done before, and God took care of him. He was thrown into a den of lions, and the king got very distressed. You can read how distressed the king was when this happened. And yet God used Daniel in a mighty way. Take care of your bodies. Take care of your minds. Take care of your egos. Take care of your work. And take care of your spiritual lives, my brothers and sisters. And I believe we'll see God working in some exciting and stimulating ways here in Queensland, throughout Australia, with people who come with minor problems, and even with those who have many of the major problems that we have talked about as we look at the whole social issues in our society.